over life, as your wealth increases, as your income increases, maybe your situation gets a little bit more complex, well, you may need to see a financial advisor. Now, we know that not everyone needs a financial advisor, but I believe at different times, people need financial advice. I myself have been engaged with a financial advisor to get advice for different things. I'm a recovering financial advisor, and that's why today I've got some experts in the room with me to answer all of your questions. I'm joined by Scott Taylor and Alex Luck. They're from Everest Wealth. They're here in Perth, but they help listeners all over Australia. They're also on our approved, trusted panel of advisors. They've been vetted by me. Their business has been around for longer than 10 minutes. I have complete confidence with anyone chatting to them about their own financial circumstances. You can search Everest Wealth, check them out, or you can just hang around, listen in. We'll have some fun along the way. We'll answer your questions. My name's Glenn James, and this is Money.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Scott and Alex, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to be here.
All right, just a name mic check. The voice of Scott is...
This is Scott.
And...
This is Alex.
There you go, everyone. It's always confusing because it's like, who's who? I'm Glenn, everyone. Hey, let's get right into it. There was a heap of questions in the Facebook group. I'm going to start with an anonymous question. Scandalous. Who's going to answer this one? You guys going to fight about it? All right, Alex might answer it. When do you know it's time to go and see a financial advisor? Should you have a certain amount saved or have particular assets to be worth it? What areas can they provide advice on? Also, as a part two, does a statement of advice cover certain things or is it specific to why you're seeking the advice? So a couple of things there. We might just talk about once you answer the first part of that, what a statement of advice is. But effectively, I'll hand it over to Alex to chat to Anon's question.
Yeah, perfect. And great question to kick us off and something that we get semi-frequently, particularly with people looking to seek financial advice for the first time. This is a pretty common question. So the answer really is as early as possible somewhat, because the earlier you can get some advice means that you can limit mistakes, improve ways to build your wealth quicker, and really define what your goals are going to be going forward too. But to try and get a little bit more specific, I guess, in terms of the time to at least start thinking about it, generally I think 2 years full-time or 2 years sort of into your career, so you've established yourself a little bit, got your foothold on what you're going to do work-wise for a little bit, and normally have a full-time income, I think is a good starting point. Having preferably none or very little consumer debt, I think, is really important as well. So you're in a position where you can start to direct some of your surplus towards some of your financial goals, not just a case of having to pay down a credit card or Afterpay, which you hear less of these days, but it'll come back, I'm sure. And then the final, I guess, sort of point of those three things is making sure you have a little bit of a buffer behind you, so possibly an emergency fund, or you're close to to building up what that sort of needs to be. So again, you're in a position where you've got no consumer debt, you've started your full-time career, so you're starting to earn some half-decent money, and you've got a little bit of a savings buffer behind you as well. I think though, if you have those three things in place, that's a really good starting point or foundation to then start exploring how a financial advisor may be able to help you.
Yeah, and I think that kind of ties back into why I started this podcast and the Glenn James Spending Plan to start with, like in 2018. For me as an advisor, I was put in this position where people would come to me for quote unquote financial advice, but it's like, I can't do anything. You need to get your spending under control. You need to pay down your debt. We need to get, at least the ball rolling with a bit of an emergency fund. Then we can step into it. I mean, the only other thing there, Alex, is if someone, we're seeing a big transfer of wealth happening in Australia at the moment, like if someone inherited significant wealth and they were 10 months into their career, well, obviously you'd need to consider some advice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like that inheritance moment, which we, like you said, we're starting to see more and more of as there's a bit of a transfer of wealth from the boomer generation down to the millennials and the Gen Zs. So yeah, because that's, you know, often that's a substantial amount of money that's somewhat life-changing. So it is important that you do seek advice to make sure that you really maximize, you know, what you've received. So those things are good sort of trigger points, I think, as well of when to seek some advice. Likewise, you know, other more sort of generic things is, you know, potentially you're looking to start a family or, you know, you're moving in with your partner, so you're getting a bit serious there as well. So you're looking to combine incomes. These things are, again, sort of, or maybe it's a large promotion, right? Mm. You know, potentially.
Yeah, it's almost like flashpoints in your financial life.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, there's another couple of questions here from Brooke and Elizabeth. I'll read both of them and I might throw over to Scott to have a chat about that. Advice on how to choose a financial advisor in the first place. About to try to find one to engage for the first time and have no idea where to start. And then Elizabeth said, what about the advisor fee structure? What should I anticipate to pay for a statement of advice? A flat fee, an hourly rate, and so on. Is it a case of you get what you pay for? Actually, just swing back to Alex for a minute. Statement of advice, SOA, what is that document? Because it's been mentioned twice here.
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's the legal term for your financial plan. So ASIC have decided we call it statement of advice, although in the public it would be known as financial plan in the layman term. So what you get within your statement of advice is effectively, yeah, the advice the financial advisor has provided to you. It should be specific to your situation. So depending on what your goals were or your reason for seeking that advice, it would have the strategies outlined within that document as well in terms of how we're going to go about achieving that advice. And then it would potentially have some product recommendations which fit those strategies as well, along with things like what you're paying the advisor will be in there clearly outlined as well. You know, potentially if they're doing some insurance and they're receiving an insurance commission for that, that will be clearly outlined as well, along with, yeah, all the, you know, the T's and C's and everything else that comes with it.
And I think I just want to touch on there, like we always see, and I might make this point and then hand it over to you, Scott. We see online people like, can I just call an advisor, pay them an hour for advice, give them a few hundred dollars and then get on with my life? Because you as a professional have to provide advice in a formalized legal framework, I can't just say, Scott, should I buy shares in this? And you're like, yeah, it sounds good. All right, see ya. Woo! Like, you have to put the hours and the effort to build that advice document so not only the consumer has protections, but you as the advisor and the advice provider has protections.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, like that example of someone buying shares and asking what I should buy, that could affect so many other parts of their life. So that's where we kind of, a financial planner's duty or advisor's duty is to get to know the person inside out. So then the recommendation of, yeah, let's buy some shares is one that does make sense in their overall life picture and their goals as well. So yeah, that can't really be done.
Yeah. Yep.
So in terms of how to choose a financial advisor, which was Brooke's question, so it's a great, great question, and there are 13,000 financial advisors in Australia, so there's a lot out there. So how do I find the right one? I feel there's a few important factors that you should look at when choosing one. So the first one I would look at would be, do these financial advisors work with people like me, or are they mainly dealing with retirees? So then it may not be better suited to me, who I'm in my 20s. What other people have had experiences with them? So checking out their reviews on Google or Facebook as well is a good gauge. Do I get a good vibe in any initial dealings? Most financial advisors these days will offer a free initial kind of phone call at least for 10, 15 minutes. So do I get a good vibe and from that call is another start. And then just having a look at who they're licensed through and what their approved product list, I think, is important as well. So are they kind of only allowed to use a certain number of products, I think, is important, because then that may sway a decision too.
It's a fair thing to say that most licensed advisors now, it's not 10 years ago where if you go to AMP, you're only going to get AMP products. Like, you know, guys like you in your business, you've got a pretty open APL product list that you can recommend, right?
Yeah. Most financial advisors now would have a pretty open where you can pretty much use any product. And when I say product, I'm talking about different super funds, different insurance companies, different investment platforms. That's a product. But most financial advisors these days can pretty much use anyone that they deem most appropriate for that person.
But yeah, on that, it's a good question to ask when you have that sort of initial phone call. It's maybe you don't necessarily have to trawl through their website to try and find it and stuff like that. It's a good starting point to simply be like, in terms of products, do you have an open approved product list or are you quite limited? It's a good question to ask.
And how much, you know, I don't love mentioning exact prices for businesses because if someone listens in 3 years and the world's changed, well, it's not relevant. But talk to us about pricing.
Yeah, so that was Elizabeth's question around kind of fee structures and flat fee, hourly rate and so forth. So every business is very different. There's probably two main methods, though, that a financial advisor will charge. The most common one, and in our business, this is how we would charge you, would be a fixed fee, flat advice fee structure. The other way advisors can charge is a percentage-based fee, so potentially a percentage of your super balance it may be or something like that.
Yeah, it's a bit yuck, that one.
Yeah. As a business, that's not how we charge. So we charge a flat fee depending on the complexity of the advice, depending if it's a single or a couple. And our fees range anywhere from kind of $4,000 as a one-off up to about $7,000 depending on complexity.
The complexity, yeah. And that's why I just wanted to camp there a little bit. You may be outraged with that, but the amount of time that goes into providing formal advice, it's wild, isn't it? Like how many, have you guys calculated how many kind of total hours that your team would put in on an advice document?
Yeah, we have. We ran this exercise to actually get to the point of how we price because, as you're well aware, it's an open market, so an advisor can charge effectively what they deem appropriate. It was something like 20 hours of an advisor time in terms of face-to-face, the checking of work, the producing of work, and then another 20 to 30 hours of actual behind the scenes, other people within the business processing and
implementing. Recommendations. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because you've got obviously the advice piece, which is, you know, what are we doing and what's our strategy? And then you've also got the implementation part, which is, okay, we're happy with that now. Mm. How do we now put this in place? And an advisor will generally help you do all of that too. Yeah.
And I just wanted to jump in and just remind everyone, the listeners of This Is Money, on average, or the median or whatever it is, it basically ends up around 100 grand anyway. The listener avatar across all our incomes who are people that are listening are $100,000 a year, right? Probably a little bit higher now because we haven't done a survey for a couple of years. And you may need to pay to get full financial advice 4% of your annual income. And I just want everyone to be okay. This is a professional service. It's one-on-one. It's high touch. It's personalized. And unfortunately, and we could talk all day about the government removing red tape to make your life easier to reduce those hours, which is, I think it will happen over the coming years. The Levy review and all that's, you know, getting underway. I would expect the prices to come down a little bit and for the advice costs to be more competitive because the government have a real mandate to do that. But one of the questions about how to find an advisor, the reason that I've got an effective trusted panel of advisors and a referral service, and you can go to thisis.money and click get help if you want an advisor. We look at someone's situation and we make an on-balance call that based on the data that they've given us, we think Scott and Alex would be the most appropriate fit for them. So it's kind of almost a word of mouth recommendation as opposed to just picking an advisor and, oh, we mainly do aged care advice. Just because your uncle and auntie use this advisor, like I've just saved a whole heap of time for the listener to match them with an appropriate advisor who's not going to screw them and also the business to respect their time So I don't know. I'm just ranting at this point.
No, but I think it's a good point. Like, we've obviously known you for a number of years. You understand how we operate. We know how you operate now as well. So there's that mutual trust and a lot of who we were helping before, which is one of the reasons why I guess we initially sort of caught up, is typically our clients sort of range in age, for example, between that sort of 25 to 45 sort of mark. So, which is a lot of, again, obviously the listener base typically of This Is Money. So, you know, we're familiar with, you know, people in that stage of life, I guess, as well. And a lot of the time for a lot of our clients, it's just once-off advice as well. So, you know, we don't have heaps and heaps of ongoing clients necessarily, because a lot of the clients in that space don't necessarily need ongoing advice. They might need an initial good sort of fit out that then sort of suits them for a number of years, and then they potentially come back and re-engage as well.
And I think a big myth that I see out there in Facebook groups and whatnot is the fact that people are worried that an advisor is getting built-in and hidden commission from their investment. And that's just not the case anymore. You want an advisor to help, they charge a fee. There is no hidden commission in super, your investment account. It is against the law and it's not possible now.
Absolutely. Since the Royal Commission, that's all gone from any products. So, your parents or grandparents may have those concerns, which are valid concerns from the past, but the industry has definitely been cleaned up the last 5-10 years now.
And just adding back to the question before we had about the statement of advice, so within that as well is disclosed everything that the advisor receives. So yeah, the one-off fee, and if said they are receiving a commission possibly from an insurance product, that all has to be in there. And if it's not, it's illegal.
And I think as a society, and I think this is categorically a true statement, when the Royal Commission into misconduct into banking and financial services occurred, and when there was misconduct, and this is the whole thing, they never profiled, here are 5,000 successful advice stories, like, because it was about misconduct, right? But we do have to protect the most vulnerable and all that. But as a society, we've agreed that built-in commission on mortgages and life insurance is okay. And it's also disclosed. So I don't know, but it is disclosed in the statement of advice.
That's correct. It 100% has to be disclosed. Now, is it the best model to use? Possibly not, but is it the best one we have? Personally, I think it is. A lot of people don't want to pay a one-off fee for a mortgage advice or to get an insurance needs analysis done. Like, they're more comfortable with knowing what the premium is or what the loan is going to cost, and then that broker.
But that makes like mortgage businesses and the insurance part of the advice world a socialist model. So advisors and brokers will win some and lose some, and they might spend a week working on this deal and get a small amount from the bank, and then they'll do the next loan, which takes 10 minutes, and get a huge amount of commission from the bank. So it is kind of just a bit of a socialist model, that commission world. But it is all disclosed. And, you know, my mortgage broker takes a commission, but he works for it. it's a fee payment mechanism for that service. So anyway, at the risk of talking shop and me having more rants, or actually I will bring up something.
Hit us.
I've actually got a bone to pick with you guys. Now, this is going to test the friendship and the relationship. I referred a listener to you based on the information that they provided to me. I thought Everest Wealth is the most appropriate fit for this listener. They might be listening. I forget the name. I forget the age. I forget the gender. I just conceptually referred someone to you. They wrote back to me basically having a whinge about all this stuff. And if someone writes back and has a whinge about anyone on my referral panel, I need to actually investigate. I don't need to know their personal details. I'm more about the client experience and, you know, what happened. Yeah, so this person, and you might not know who the person is or if you or another team member spoke with them. This person came back and said, I just wanted some advice in relation to my share portfolio and some additional investing. And they just didn't get it. They kept asking about these other stuff and almost asking about my whole situation. So what happened, or what would have likely happened in that situation? Why, you know, they've come to you for this one thing. Like, what would have happened?
Yeah, so like I was saying a bit earlier, it's very hard or near on impossible because we've got an obligation to get to know you as the client in totality and your overall picture and how investing affects paying off your mortgage or some other goals you may have of retiring earlier or starting a family or whatnot, that we need to know everything about your picture. Like it's impossible for us, for someone to come to us and go, I've got $50,000, help me invest it. I'm not saying that that's what the situation was. It's our duty to get to know someone in totality. So what would have happened would have been we would have politely said, well, we're unable to help you at this stage due to you not wanting to disclose your full picture, which is fine, but we just can't legally help them.
Yeah, because we have something which is called the best interest duty. So an advisor has to act in your best interest legally.
Right.
So it's very hard to probably stand in front of a judge and be like, well, I acted in Glenn's best interests, when the judge is like, well, you didn't actually take down all his information. You didn't know he had a kid or you didn't know he had a mortgage or something like that. And now you've gone and provided this advice without the full picture.
Right. And I think what I wrote back, I said, hey, apologies, it wasn't the right match. In that instance, I think I said it might be most appropriate for you to research robo-advisors.
Yeah, so I think because we do help people with one-off investment advice. I want to make that clear.
Yeah.
But like Scott said, we do need to know the full picture before we can then say come back to that point.
But the whole thing as well, and this is where it gets to the personal advice, like if someone came to you as an advisor, like, I just want investment advice, and you're like, all right, let's have a chat. You might see opportunities based on their goals for the investing to optimize the structure to actually save their money with tax, or if it's like, well, I think if we do a little bit of salary sacrifice there with the super, we'll do that for the next 5 years and then you do this, you'll be all good. And the advice pays for itself and they save tax along the way.
Yeah, 100%. So we take a holistic view, right? So let's take that example. You come to us with one-off investing advice, but I can see your super isn't really being optimized either. You know, you're sitting in the wrong investment strategy for your age. You're paying way too many fees. You know, you might not have an insurance strategy in place. You know, there's tax savings that we can make. So it comes back to like, we can't fully know that without knowing your entire situation.
Mm. And that's it. Like if you go to a financial advisor, you're getting personal financial advice. And it's just like if I go to the doctor and said, oh, hey, I keep getting these jolts of pain down my leg. And if the doctor said to me, oh, okay, have you had headaches or have you been dizzy lately? I'm like, shut your mouth. I'm here about my leg. Why are you asking about my headaches? And why are you asking if I'm being dizzy? And the doctor's like, well, I need to have a look to see if you're not having a friggin' aneurysm. Anyway.
No, good analogy.
So let's move along. Hey, I'm going to grab a drink of water, then we're going to come back and just rip into some listener questions now that we've kind of positioned advice that it isn't for everyone at all times. I just want to make that clear. But if you do engage with a financial advisor, guess what? You're going to have to pay for it. And guess what? You're going to get a high-touch personalized service. And guess what? Your goals will be met. And guess what? We'll be back right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Radio, we are back. Before I grabbed my water, we touched on this robo-advisor thing. What's a robo-advisor?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's definitely something which has become more popular, and I think will continue to become more popular over time. Effectively, what it's trying to do, as you mentioned before, obviously, in a traditional, well, if you go see a financial advisor right now, it is obviously, there's a cost to that, okay, as we sort of already established. A robo-advisor is trying to, I guess, meet that part of the market where you potentially don't need the full high-touch entire sort of financial plan at this point in time. Maybe you just need more specific investment advice. And what it will then typically do is ask you a series of questions around, say, your investor profile. So how long are you investing for? You know, how much are you sort of looking to invest? Are you going to contribute ongoing? These sorts of things. And then it can help tailor a potential investing strategy around that, as an example, for a much lower fee than seeing, say, a financial advisor.
Because the way I see it, it's like, hello, I am a robot. Do you want to invest? And they're like, yeah, how much do you have? Yes. Okay. What is your risk profile?
You sound Russian.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and then, so basically just like, they may provide a limited SOA. So one of the questions about the SOA, the robo-advisors will just scope out everything else and only address investing. Now, the thing is, I think a robo-advisor will literally just choose a portfolio based on your risk profile, and it won't provide tax advice on entity structure. It won't provide any other overarching considerations. So it is very limited. And, you know, going back to, if you're seeing a financial advisor, we're going to look at the whole situation and optimize your whole financial life, not just compartmentalizing.
Yeah, because that is very common that we see in terms of the structuring of investments through couples. We usually see when people have not received advice before or through robo-advice that the investment's set up in the higher income earner's name. Now, that may be warranted, but a lot of the time that just leads to a higher amount of tax to pay when that person makes money per se. So, yeah, it definitely doesn't take into account the holistic view. So it's good for a gap in the market, but in our eyes, that's about it, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say as well that typically the products that they recommend are quite scoped as well. So,
yeah.
You know, advisor.
Well, it's going to basically be their products.
Yeah, that's right. So you're only going to, and there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, but it may not be. Yeah, there actually, might be another one that's cheaper on the market, which is the same thing.
Yes, coming up on the podcast, I've booked a campfire chat with Vince and Chris Bricky from StockSpot. So, you know, that we'll talk about this stuff. And again, like, everyone just needs to have a cold shower. Like, not every product and every person and every profession is for everyone. So, everyone, I'm just sick of the outrage when people are like, oh, I don't want that or I don't need that. Well, that's fine, don't. I'm in a mood. Let's see what Stefan... Let's see what Stefan has asked. Benefits/pros of topping up previously unused super caps before tax changes come into play in July. So maybe just give us a lay of the land on what he's talking about with this topping up caps and all that stuff.
Yep. So there's two things here. So with the unused super caps, so that's where you can go back on the last 5 years in, plus the year that we're in, and top up the contributions that you may not have made up to the cap. Now, the cap is at the moment $27,500. If we look back over the last 5 years to kind of 3 years plus ago, it was $25,000. Next year, it's going to $30,000. So if through your employer contributions, you haven't met that cap, which a lot of people wouldn't, say you're earning $100,000, $11,000 or 11% is going in, then you can go back on the years and make a big one-off payment. Now, why would you do that? To get a large tax deduction, get more money into super, pay minimal tax in your potentially in your own name. So that's what the unused super cap is. Very kind of good for people that get one-off big bonuses and they just see half of it go to the ATO.
Yep. So just as another way to explain it, just for people who are, you know, like me, the unused cap is the concessional contributions that don't get used from your employer. So the current cap is $27,500.
Or salary sacrifice.
Or salary sacrifice. Yep. So if someone's employer contribution put in 500 in that year, for that year you've got $10,000 of unused cap. And if that happened for 5 years, there'd be $50,000 that you could use and put that $50,000 into super and claim a tax deduction on that.
Yeah, assuming your balance is under $500,000 as of 1st of July, which is the other caveat there. So then the second part of this is around the tax changes. So there's been a lot in the media recently about the Stage 3 tax cuts, which is what Stefan's talking about here. So what's effectively happening is a couple of the tax brackets are being reduced in the amount of tax that's being paid. So the 18,000 to 45,000 caps going from 19 cents in the dollar to 16 cents and so forth. So what it's effectively going to mean is you'll get a lower tax deduction if you wait till next year to do this versus this year, this financial year.
Right. So if you've got unused caps and some extra cash kicking around, you may need to
get some advice, but it may make sense to do it this financial year because the tax rates are higher, meaning you'll save theoretically more tax. Now, if you're earning kind of 250 plus, it's not going to make a difference because the tax rates aren't really changing for the high income earners. But if you're in the bracket of 50 to 130, then it's going to save you a bit of money. Just as an example for Stefan's benefit, we just did a little quick example. So someone earning $120,000, if they've got $30,000 unused cap and they make that as a contribution, that would yield them approximately $9,750 tax refund at the moment if they did it this year at 32.5% versus if they waited to next year, the tax rate's dropping for that person to 30 cents in the dollar, so they would save, get a refund of $9,000. So it's about a $750 difference in that scenario.
In that gross scenario. Yeah. But you've got to remember, Stefan, you've got to take off the 15% contributions tax.
Yeah, in both scenarios. So that's not
changing. Yeah, if you're earning under $250,000.
Yeah. So there's a lot at play. So like you said before, best to get advice for sure, but in most situations, it probably makes more sense to do it this side of July.
Yeah. And just a question on notice from me, who's slumped over this lounge in my suite here at the Western in Perth. It's a good little place. When wouldn't you suggest someone makes additional contributions to super?
Yeah, in a few scenarios. So when someone's earning probably under $45,000 to start with because the tax saving just is quite minimal. The other side is when a high income earner, say over 250, because then you've got an extra super tax to pay on top of that, plus they've probably reached their cap, so then they're paying an additional tax if they breach it and don't have any unused super space. So those kind of income scenarios. But then also if their goals are around buying a property, being debt-free, dropping an income to have kids, so that their goals don't really match having less money coming into the system. Because if I'm putting money into super via salary sacrifice, I'm getting paid less. If I'm putting some of my savings into super, I've got less savings to put towards my other goals. So that would be kind of the other reasons there.
Mm.
But the other, and probably lastly would be if someone's main goal is to potentially retire earlier, we can only access super at the moment after the age of 60, and that those rules may change by the time all of us get there. But at the moment, it's set at 60. So if we want to fully retire by the time we're 55, then it may not be useful to put heaps of money into super because we may need to be debt-free and have other investments so we can live off until we get to that age.
Yeah, I had a client the other day who was mid-30s, and she was just salary sacrificing completely up to the cap every year. And the reason was basically a colleague at work had told her to do that, which, you know, don't always listen to your colleagues at work. So it's not bad advice from a tax perspective, but she kind of didn't realize until I sort of pointed out to her that she was just locking up so much money now in her super fund, and she was only 35, which, you know, in theory now she can't access for another 30 years.
I mean, it's circumstantial because I'm about to question whether I say this or not, but whatever, I will. I'm about to actually put a non-concessional contribution into my super, which looking in, that could be so wild. Like, why, Glenn, why would you put money after tax into your super?
Tell us more.
Over lunch, I will. But this is the whole thing. It's lunacy for someone to be like, why are you putting 100 grand into your super? Well, my situation, is this and it's mine. So I am putting money into super, knowing that I can't touch it. But I'm knowing that my wealth can grow at a more tax effective rate within super.
Yeah, and it also then enables you, the quicker you grow it, then there's other options that open up, like self-managed super funds. And
I've got one of them.
Oh, dear, nice.
Yeah.
Purchasing property and stuff like that. So it opens up more doors the more money you have in super, and it's that effect of compound as well. The more money we have, the easier it is to make money.
And I assume, you know, you're a smart guy sometimes.
You're not probably,
really. I'll give you a little bit of credit. That you've, you know, you've done your numbers and you know your resources and stuff like that as well. So if you're pretty sweet on the personal side, or you can sort of see how that's tracking and you're going to be okay there, then yeah, it's a great place to put money, you know.
Yeah.
Lower tax.
Hey, question just on the whole super and the tax rate. We mentioned it before. If someone out there is earning more than $250 a year, the contributions tax is effectively 30%, right?
Which Correct.
It's not scandalous, because where I'm from, 30 is still less than 49%, right?
Yep.
So it's still a good thing. The actual, that rate is only there on the contributions. It doesn't make that super account tax rate 30%, does it, on the growth? It's
no.
Just the contributions.
But that's what they're looking at bringing in, which is over that $3 million mark where you then pay 30% on the growth, which is an index. So that could be an issue for a lot of the listeners.
But how crazy is it? Like, they're talking about taxing unrealized gains in super.
Yeah.
Like lunacy.
Absolutely. Because it drops and then you paid tax on money you don't have.
Yeah. It's just absolutely quite crazy. Elizabeth said, shares as a couple, is it best to buy in one person's name? I suppose the lower income earner, or both names, or both buy different ETFs. Ooh, strategy now is just continuing to expand my name's portfolio, but would it be best to move forward to buy in a shared named manner? Like, it's all joint anyway, she's saying. This is interesting. And I do want you to chew on this, guys. Elizabeth, one of the points that you made there was, or both buy different ETFs, don't conflate ownership structure and tax with investing structure. That's what I'll say. But do one of you guys want to answer do we go joint, solo, or give all the money to Glenn?
Yeah, sure, Glenn. I'll take this. So thanks for the question, Elizabeth. I guess the first one to look at is, like Glenn's harped on about, is the structure. So who earns what, and what's the future outlook as well? So not only the here and now, like, oh, I'm on maternity leave, I'm only earning $50,000 where my partner's earning $150,000, but maybe you're in an occupation where you will go back full time and your earning potential is a lot higher than your partner. So it's not only looking at the now of your earnings, but also the future, because the here and now, you'll pay tax on any dividends or income drawn from the account, but you've also got to look at the future of when you may be selling the portfolio and paying tax on any capital gains, which we hope we will have, what the tax rate may be. So what we look at is the structure there, and usually it is the lower income earner's name. But if there's a bit of unknown in the future, sometimes we have recommended in the past that there is an account in each person's name set up, if the platform then is deemed appropriate, where it's not ridiculous fees and stuff. Because if it's $10 a trade and we're putting $100 a month in each account, well, that's 10% of the return already gone. So we don't want to kind of chew away a lot of our earning growth on fees. But I guess I digress there. It's really about getting the structure right. So probably does make sense to have it in the lower income earning name. And then from there, that's where you look at the profile of the ETFs and looking at, do you have any beliefs around how the investment is? So I don't want to invest in fossil fuels. So that will screen out particular ETFs. And then you want to ideally have a diversified kind of setup and portfolio from there.
No, that's all right. Actually, there's another question here from Daniel Quinn, regular pest in the Facebook group. Hey, Dan, how are you? He said, the difference between once-off advice and continuing advice.
Yes, that's a really good question, and it's something that we get pretty regularly as well, because, again, it can be a little bit confusing. How does the financial advice world work? I think one of the concerns people sort of that are first-timers, which are most of the people that come to see us, that they're somehow locked into us for life if they go ahead. However, that's definitely not the case. So broadly speaking, the differences between sort of one-off advice versus continuing advice. So one-off advice would effectively help you define what your financial goals are going to be, so where you want to be and what you want to be doing. Included in that advice would then be these strategies to achieve these, and then it would often include the implementation of such advice as well, including normally some product recommendations if it's deemed appropriate. Continuing advice. So basically, in that example, you've got the advice, you know how to do it, and it's been set up, and then you're now on your own to basically track that and keep yourself accountable, etc. So continuing advice, how does that sort of work? So generally it involves regular catch-ups or touch points between yourself and the advisor. It can be based on then the evolution of those goals throughout time, including adapting the strategy based on changes in your life and changes in basically what's going on, including potentially some changes in product, because maybe now another product comes out that's more appropriate, as an example. And really, the continuing advice can be used for big changes or small changes. So I've tried to sort of break those down. So big changes would be like, you go from being single to now being having a partner and being financially together. A big financial decision such as looking to purchase a house or your first investment property, having kids, promotion at work, inheritance, which we talked about before. And then I guess the smaller changes are some of the benefits of maybe having a continuing relationship with an advisor, which may be a little bit more intangible, include things like, updates on legislation. So this year, we were going to get these tax rate cuts. Now they've changed. The super cap is going to change for next year as well.
So it could let people know who you're in ongoing contact with that, hey, this will impact you. You should consider coming in and jumping online, we'll discuss how we can actually do this before July.
100% right. So, as Scott mentioned before, you might have some unused cap or concessional cap sitting there that you weren't really aware of, and now you're earning more than where you were 2 years ago, so it actually is beneficial to potentially use some of that to reduce your tax, as an example. And I guess other than I guess the main sort of intangible thing with that as well is then, some accountability. So often while you have a personal trainer or something like that.
Keep not only, you focused and dialed in.
Keep you focused, not only like get the technique right, but keep you focused and dial in and keep you rocking up. Along with, I guess, what we do for some of the ongoing clients that we have is we also track the progress.
Right.
So that's always, I think that's really good to see. So, because a lot of the time, you might look back 12 months and be like, I feel like I really haven't achieved anything. But if you're able to sort of track that correctly, you can sort of see like, oh, wow, I actually have made a bit of progress the last 12 months. And then if I look back the last 5 years, wow, look where I am now as well.
If someone was in an ongoing relationship with their advisor, and particularly your business, could they literally, if they saw an ad on Instagram, put $5,000 in this and you'll be rich overnight. Could they flick you an email and go, saw this, is this BS or not? Can they bounce stuff that they see or have any questions about random stuff off their advisor in your world?
Yeah, definitely. And we get stuff like that all the time from our ongoing clients. Or it might be, I was chatting to Glenn at work and he mentioned, this crypto thing, I don't really understand it. What's the deal with that? Do you think it's any benefit for me? So we can then, jump on and have a quick Teams call, or Zoom call, or something like that to explain it, or perhaps it's just an email back. Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
But you don't have to have it.
Yes.
I think that's the key thing. So, with us, if you come to see us at Everest Wealth, you don't have to have it. Some financial advice firms, it will be a contingent of getting that initial advice. But there are advisors out there like us that will just provide one-off advice as well.
So, for example, I know advisors and their minimum once-off fee or their statement advice fee is like $14,000. So back to that question at the start, they're obviously just playing in a different pool. It might be ultra high net worth or complexities. And then it was funny, there was in the Facebook group, and hello if you're listening, I forget who you are. We got onto this chat about should the price of advice be regulated? And you pull that thread and you've got a capitalism versus socialism discussion before you know it. And I think there is that dance between, allowing businesses to charge what they want, because you guys could turn around tomorrow and go, our advice fees are 20 grand each. You're going to get a lot of clients not come.
Yeah, that's right.
So the market kind of dictates. So there is that critical mass of, we need to you know, pay our staff and our rent and, you know, run our business and provide value. But for those who might charge that huge 15 grand amount, I mean, it's just it's another thing, and they might be doing that because they only want complex clients and all that. I don't know.
But it's like you said, it comes back to, so I'm probably a little bit more on the capitalism side, I guess, to it. Well, more of like the economic side of it. So it's demand and supply. So we could charge 100 grand, right? No one would rock up. So we'd be out of business from the get-go. But yeah, potentially that person that charges the 14, they're still around because there are clients that they can help and they see value in that fee. So I think when you have that initial chat with the advisor, and that's something that we do when you come to see us, it's, you know, answering your initial questions, explaining our process, you know, the areas that we would focus on to help you and how we charge and what we charge for that. So you get a really clear picture of how it all works and then what you're up for if you want to go ahead. And then you simply make a decision at that point in time. Yep, sounds worth it to me, or thanks but no thanks, which is perfectly fine as well.
Yeah, sweet. Okay, Samantha asked, how does a financial planner essentially plan for a couple's future, e.g. kids, including daycare, cars, updated house, or do they focus on wealth accumulation only?
So it depends. In terms of focusing on wealth accumulation only, it depends what you need as our client. So a lot of what we do is building people's wealth, but a lot of people's goals as well is around preserving wealth, or it might be other goals like starting a family and stuff, which isn't really wealth accumulation. It's building your family out and going to probably be a larger expense than what you currently have. So in short, no, it's not just wealth accumulation that a typical financial advisor would assist a client with. Mm. I guess the process, or our process for helping people plan for couples plan for their future, is working through a bit of a process around, well, what are your goals? So we want to get quite specific where we can around what your goals are, putting a dollar figure where we can on them. So if it's an upgrade of the home, what areas do we like? What's the median house value? What are we aiming for there? And a time frame as well. So if it's buying the house, or if it's starting a family, look, we're going to start trying in 6 months. So yeah, if it's buying a house or starting a family, understanding in an ideal time frame when that is, and where it sits in the order of priority. So because it might be that we work through all the goals and not everything can be achieved. It might be that one has to be foregone, or you have to push the time frame out of the house purchase to be able to start a family. So once we've got that, then we need to know the ins and out of someone's cash flow. So how much do we earn, and how much goes out the door, and then working through what the effect on someone's cash flow is of each of those goals. So as an example, if we're starting a family, which is what Samantha was suggesting there, was that where there's going to be less income due to potential maternity leave, how long that's going to last. When we do return to work, is it likely to be 2 or 3 days a week, which is, again, less income than what we're used to, and then potentially higher expenses with daycare. So taking that into account as well. And if we look at, say, upgrading the home, well, then there's going to be higher loan repayments. And how does that fit in so that we can retain still a decent lifestyle? So it's kind of looking at each goal in by itself, but then looking at the bigger picture and then helping someone prioritize those goals.
So you would do that with obviously some modeling software, so you can put the inputs in and then some potential scenarios. Like, would you do two or three different scenarios to show people, or go, look, this is what we think based on what you said, this is what it could look like, but if you're not sure if you're going to work an extra year before you start a family, we can just do a slight tweak for you?
Yeah. So there's usually, two or three different scenarios to start with that we present in our first kind of strategy meeting, where we're starting to work through the different modelling, and then that usually gets people starting to think around, okay, but what if this, or what if this, and we can go away and refine it, report back with an updated version with more kind of scenarios. And at the end of the day, life changes, so we don't know what scenario is going to play out to the exact T, but it at least gives people peace of mind and comfort.
Well, it gives people a good direction. It's like, this is the direction we need to walk. We know that there will be ebbs and flows and changes along the way, but this is the best shot that we've got with the information and the life style and stage right at today.
Yeah, spot on. And then when stuff does change in people's lives or incomes or expenses, then the ship can be turned in whatever way, but we're already heading in the right direction.
Yeah, sweet. Francis asked, why do I need a financial advisor rather than just a mortgage broker and a handful of good ETFs?
Well, a financial advisor will advise great ETFs for starters. No, that's just my attempt at being funny. The answer is
they will advise the most appropriate ETFs, if I'm not mistaken.
Look, potentially you don't. To answer, in earnest, if you've got your financial goals down and you've got a strategy and you're happy with that and it's working, then yeah, you just keep doing you. However, I guess some of the limitations with that potentially is, a mortgage broker can't provide financial advice, so they're not going to be able to help you identify any gaps in your strategy necessarily. They're not going to be able to advise you on tax. They're not going to be advise you, effectively what may be missing or a more efficient way from getting from A to B. They're there to obviously provide you, the best loan, which is appropriate based on your situation. So that's potentially more where, a financial advisor effectively adds value. It's sitting down with you and holistically looking at your entire situation and listening to where you want to be and working with you to find the most efficient way to achieve that.
Yeah, because realistically, if you had a house with a mortgage and there was equity in it, you could rock up to the mortgage broker and go, hey, I want to cash out $200,000 of equity, separate split, and then go dump that in your own ETF account. Like, you can do that. It's fine. The question is, do you need someone else to be looking into going, is this the most appropriate way to optimize your overall year-on-year position with tax? Like, I've got friends, and hello, if you're listening, you know who you are. Like, you've got more money than God. You're trying to do it all your own way. I'm literally telling them, like, you need to get advice because trust me, this is not optimized the way you're doing it. But some people, you can drag a horse to water, you can tickle it to water, you can ride it to water, you can lead it, you can do whatever. But if that horse ain't ready to have a drink, it's never going to until it's ready, and it might not. So, I don't know.
You must riff on that. Yeah, I agree. It's very hard to make a horse drink water that it doesn't want to.
Jai Mitchell, can you talk about child cover? What age is it from? What it covers? How much it may cost? I only recently found out it existed. He also proceeded to say income protection is tax deductible, but I assume it's not if it's inside super? Hold my beer. So is it better to pay for it pre-tax inside super or claim, I think he's got his wording wrong here, or claim the tax deduction outside super?
So I think he's saying, do I make a contribution and claim that?
Oh, right.
To make up for the premium coming out of super. So I'll answer that question first. So yeah,
maybe I'm the odd one out here. I think I get it now.
So yeah, income protection is tax deductible if you pay it personally from your bank account. You then claim it in at the end of the year when you do your tax return. If you pay for income protection through super, it is still tax deductible, but it's tax deductible to the super fund. It's just at a much lower rate typically than what your marginal tax rate will be. So the super fund tax rate's 15%. So it still gets a tax deduction, but at 15% compared to your marginal tax rate. So if you're earning $100,000, that's going to be 32.5% plus the Medicare levy. In terms of, is it better to pay for it outside of super versus super? It depends. It depends on that person's situation, what age they are, what their goals are and their holistic view. If they need more money in personally to build their savings for a house or whatever it may be. But in terms of the comment, Jai, around do I make a contribution, which I assume I'm interpreting this correct, make a contribution to super. So say your premium is $2,000 a year for income protection and that comes out of your super, and you put $2,000 into super and claim that as a tax deduction, it's going to give you the same outcome as effectively paying $2,000 out of pocket and claiming that.
One thing I love, the mind exercise to talk about with superannuation, if you're listening now and you've got a death policy, even just a death-only one, you got it on TV during the day, $500,000 death cover, paying for it out of your own bank account, that's not tax deductible. So we'll just say it would cost $500 a year out of your own bank account for $500,000 death cover. If you went to an advisor, set up a $500,000 death policy in your super fund and salary sacrificed that $500 into super, you're getting your death cover tax deductible.
Yeah, at a discounted rate.
At a discounted rate. And the catch-all there is death benefits in Australia are tax-free to the beneficiaries if it is within super, particularly if they're under 18 or a spouse.
Yeah, if they're a CIS dependent. Yeah.
That's right. So not to mention the estate planning things of locking in my beneficiary and all that stuff, but there is just no, and there could be, but I'll be dramatic, there is just like almost no instances where you would have a death policy if you got debt and dependents paid for from the friggin' TV or out of your own bank account, or if your health insurer is like, oh, do you want some death cover tacked on? And
they
wouldn't do it.
They're usually more expensive as well because it's just a giant pool of people that haven't gone through kind of underwriting or medicals.
Well, you guys, so do you guys, if someone's like, oh, friggin' love you guys sound good, I just want to review my insurances, like does Everest Wealth do insurance-only advice for people?
No, we don't. We would pass them on to Sky Wealth, who is a very popular person in your
I know Phil very well. Okay, this is why we need to catch up in person. So you guys, as from a business point of view, are like if someone wants dedicated insurance only, it's best to be handled by Sky Wealth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Phil and his team.
Yeah. But if someone's like, we want to do everything in the one place, we want some super, we want some investments, review the insurance, you would then do it as
a holistic
thing. Yeah, cool. Well, there you go. That's good. I learn something new every day. cool. Yeah, so just talk to us about this child cover stuff.
Yeah, so child cover is also known as child trauma. Very, very little knowledge around it to the general public, but effectively what it covers is if your child suffers a traumatic condition, which could be cancer, a heart condition, loss of their use of hands, feet, sight, hearing.
Or sadly death.
Yeah, or unfortunately death, yeah. So that covers, you can't take it out upon their birth. It's usually, depending on the insurer, when they're 2 or 3 years old. And it usually you can get up to $200,000 as a high end of coverage for that. It is relatively cheap because, touch wood, that doesn't happen often and it is unlikely, so it is relatively cheap.
It's about $15 a month for every insurer, isn't it? Yeah.
And that is an out-of-pocket cost that can't be paid for from superannuation.
Mm. Yeah, I was still am a big advocate of child cover. Like even if you grab $100,000 per child, at least if the worst happens, the parents can both take time off from work.
Because their insurance won't pay out because they're not the ones that are sick or injured. Yep. So that's where it's more of the benefit rather than...
And it's generally linked as a rider to a trauma policy?
Yeah, or it can be on someone's life insurance policy.
Okay, it's a standalone rider. Yeah, but I can't just rock up to the insurance company and go, I want child cover, but nothing else.
No, you need a policy on your own life as well.
Yeah, so if you do have life insurance and trauma and all that stuff already and you've got kids that are now over 2 years old, reach back out to your financial advisor or at next review, say, can we consider some child cover for the kids?
So. Yeah, absolutely. Particularly for the reasons that you guys mentioned, if it's important to you guys, because it's not particularly expensive.
Mm. I used to recommend a suite of products when I was an advisor. Both parents, if they work full time, both had income protection policies, both had trauma policies each. They automatically, per child, the IP and the trauma came with $10,000 built in. So I knew by insuring the parents there was a built-in $40,000 of free child cover that they didn't know about. And I kind of just did that and highlighted it. It's like, hey, this is there. But I think it's worth the discussion to, one, check if your current product has a built-in feature.
Yep. A lot of the new products don't.
Yes,
so if
that's
it's
right.
more of an older style product, it probably does. But best to check.
Yeah. And then talk to your advisor about adding it if you do have a newer suite of products. Yeah, sweet. Okay, here's a juicy one. From Anonymous, I'm sure they won't give this advice, and I reckon they will. If not, I will. How to break up with your financial advisor. I've had the worst experience with mine. I feel like I'm in too big of a company, which didn't even seem that big, and get passed off to their assistants to correspond with. Don't really feel like I can trust them at all to understand people's situation, and it's not even that complex. I mean, my question to Anonymous, did something change or did you always have that feeling? Did you have a weird gut feeling at the very start? And that's like everyone, don't engage if you're not vibing. And maybe that's a good question to ask an advisor. Can you tell us about your team and your processes and what happens if I proceed with ongoing advice or whatnot? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So we work really hard on basically, yeah, education and making sure that when you come to see us, there's transparency and you understand how it all sort of works together, how it fits and effectively, yeah, what you're getting and what you're paying for. That's really important. So with us, that's why, when you come to see us, you have an intro call with us initially for 15 minutes, which we answer sort of any initial questions and, again, explain sort of the process from there. We do an what's called an initial meeting after that. I'm struggling to say that, which is a little bit more of an expansion on that as well. That typically goes for 45 minutes to an hour. And past that point, that's when you should have all the information in front of you. You understand how it all works, what you're going to pay if you want to go ahead, what you're getting, and then you make a decision at that point in time. If you want to go ahead, we then move into our strategy meetings and produce the advice and then implement it. It's no different really than if you decide to become an ongoing client or not. Again, it's laid out. This is what you'll pay. This is what you'll get. I guess coming back to this question, and as you touched on before as well, because I get this question from time to time too. People will ring us up and say, look, I have an existing relationship. I'm not really happy with it. But often it's sort of disguised or misguided a little bit in terms of this is what I'm getting and this is what I'm paying. Like, do you think that's a good deal? And we have no context, right, to obviously what's gone on or what's been said or what's been provided. So we can't, again, answer that question accurately. So to me, it comes back to, as you sort of touched on then as well, Glenn, that it comes back to your gut. If you feel like you're not getting value, you're not happy with it for some reason, you need to address it. And that's either a case of then, yeah, breaking up with that advisor, as this person's potentially alluding to, or again, communicating to the advisor or the company that, what you're getting is not really what you expected and you're not potentially happy for some reason as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of how to break up, I guess it should be a pretty simple process if you do decide splitting is ultimately what you want. What I would firstly do or encourage you to do is to have a conversation with the current advisor, even if that's over email, about how you feel and that you want to be removed. Now, it depends on what products you have with them, whether it's superannuation, investments and insurances. But effectively, they should be able to be removed as the servicing advisor pretty much instantly, and any fees that you're paying cease. It would also, while you're kind of corresponding through this process, just be good to ask them if there's anything you feel that you need to keep on top of now without their guidance or without them sitting across your policies now that you'll be managing it yourself. Or your other option is to seek out a new advisor and go through the potential process again, and those products, super insurance investments, could potentially be transferred to a new advisor. That's your other option.
Yeah, and you've just got to watch, because I know, for example, I think it's Macquarie Wrap. If you don't have an advisor listed on that account, or you're not in an advice relationship, they'll want you off their platform because they don't really do B2C direct.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where sometimes, yeah, some products that are used are more aimed at advisors. So it's being aware of that before, I guess, you cease any relationships, because that may not be in your best interest. So then it may be more suitable to find a new advisor.
And I wonder if, for example, like if Anonymous is paying for an ongoing service, like they might not actually need that. And that's where there's a value misalignment, and I'm paying for something, I'm not getting the value. Well, hang on, you don't actually need that.
And look, maybe they did need it to begin with. So to give people some comfort as well, and this is getting slightly into the weeds, you have what's called an ongoing service agreement between yourself and the advisor or the company that they work for. So it's basically, this is what we're going to provide for you as part of that agreement, and this is what you're going to pay. And that is something that you need to have re-signed as well. So ours need to be re-signed every 12 months as an example. So if we have a client or you come to see us and you want to have an ongoing relationship, every 12 months we need to basically go back over that agreement and make sure that you're still going to get value from this and you still want to effectively continue. So I wouldn't recommend this, but it sounds like there's an ongoing service agreement in place. So if the Anonymous doesn't, particularly like conflict for any reason, even via email, that should just run out naturally too, as another option. Back to what you were saying with the Macquarie Wrap comment too, though, that is definitely a good point. And one thing that we try to do when you come to see us is, have that discussion initially in terms of like, do you think ongoing is going to be worthwhile or not? Because if it is, it may then potentially skew the product choice a little bit because an advisor's got access to every product that the public has plus more. However, as you just said correctly said then, if ongoing's not going to be worth it, then we don't want to then put them in a product that, yeah, for some reason they can't access that or they need to like call us for a password or something like that as well. So that's definitely something that we do consider as part of that initial process in terms of, yeah, whether ongoing or not it's going to be suitable.
And I will say, like, just to reiterate, like, everyone's like, why would I want an advisor to manage my money? Like, there are hundreds and thousands of Aussies who have building wealth, significant wealth, inheritances, and there is a level of comfort where if someone rocked up with 900 grand as an inheritance and that was invested, that they will pay an ongoing fee to be have that money effectively managed and a comfort level of I'm not interested in doing this myself. You guys handle that stuff. You guys let me know. So, you know, if you've got 20 grand to invest, it's probably not going to be Macquarie Wrap anyway. So we need to be clear that there is a big world out there and I just always need to say not every solution is for everyone.
Amen.
Mm. Well, we might leave it there. Look, we'll get you guys back on in a few months if you're over the East Coast or whatever and we can do this again. But to be honest, everyone, like a lot of the questions we answered today, it was less about the actual strategic advice stuff, but more about the structural, how do advisors work, what should I do? And it's just one of these things that we'll always keep talking about it and we'll always keep having professionals on the show because as much as Facebook and Reddit and this podcast is good, you can't get personalized advice to your situation without engaging with someone to look at your personal situation. And there does come a cost. And, you know, the reason that I wrote the book, Sort Your Money Out and Get Invested, was to basically gift wrap people ready to get advice. They're out of debt. They've got a system. They've got their emergency fund. They've got a concept of what an asset allocation means. They've got a concept of super. Now I can go and see an advisor. And it's just such a better experience if you get your own house in order first. And I believe you can do that yourself with an exception to the insurances. You need to see an advisor to get those insurances. But yeah, we'll always continue the conversation here with professional advisors as long as we're doing this money podcast. Anything you'd want to say, Scott, in finishing? And then I'll ask Alex the same thing.
Yeah, I guess my final words is that it's not a daunting process. It is, we chat to many people all the time that aren't ready to receive advice. That's why we have that 15, 20 minute phone call that's at our own cost. So we encourage people to reach out and then we'll guide them and let them know when they may be ready. But yeah, a lot of the questions that did come through was about the process and when will I be ready and things like that. There's no harm in picking up the phone. It's only a little bit of your time and you'll have a bit more guidance. And then if the time is right, then we'll let you know. And then it's up to you if you want to move forward or not.
Yeah, I would reiterate that. Like, we're not going to yell at you or something if you ring up and you're not ready. And that's where, just back to what you were saying as well, Glenn, like, this podcast is great for sort of trying to bridge that gap between, I guess, the public and the unknown of the financial advisory sort of world. And as Scott said, like, it's really not that daunting, and hopefully some of the questions that we've answered today can have shed some light on that too.
Yeah. Well, we might leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on and thanks for looking after so many of our listeners all across Australia. And just, I'll say it again, having a Perth-based business, if you're on the East Coast, pretty convenient because you can get home, throw some dinner down, and they're still in their office working. So,
especially with daylight savings at the moment, people are up there having meetings with people at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, your time.
Yeah, and yeah, you're like 5 o'clock or whatever at home. So there are advantages with doing things online, but you don't need to be face-to-face with someone.
No, I don't think so. I mean, 70% of our clients now, even the ones in WA, a lot of them are via video these days. I think since COVID, that's just the norm for a lot of people.
And you've actually got heaps of clients in Adelaide as well, don't you?
Mm, yeah, heaps of clients. I'm personally from Adelaide, place. Yeah. Shout out.
Yeah, we would actually. It's pretty much, like you said, we are nationally based.
Because you've got an advisor in Queensland.
Advisors over on the East Coast as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, there you go, everyone. Everest Wealth coming at you. Okay, bye.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have three books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.